Welcome back to the Marketect, a live podcast where leadership and product marketing intersect. As usual, thanks to the Compete Network for supporting everything that we do. I'm here with my co-host, Morgan, who brings that je ne sais quoi of, you know, sales perspective to keep us product marketers honest. Great human being, even better at what he does from his consulting perspective. Morgan, how you doing? Tell the folks a little bit about yourself.
I'm doing great. I feel like every time we do an episode of intro, you have a new like word that I don't know that you're going to say, that it's a new attribute. And I take it at the highest regard and I appreciate the compliment, but I never know what to expect. So y'all know, I never know. So this is fun.
Well, I love having you here. And especially on this show, we're going to explore two powerful tools, and both are crucial to sales success, but one especially. And, you know, these two tools, they help buyers make confident purchase decisions. And in today's day and light, especially the past couple of years, like with budgets tight, B2B buying more challenging, our peers in sales and marketing, they need all the help they can get. Most purchase processes end in no decision. That's a Matt Dixon quote that is in our guest's book, because frankly, buyers struggle. They struggle to make confident decisions. Effective positioning can be the first of the powerful tools helping companies focus and avoid waste. And it also clarifies your value, attracts profitable customers versus those, I learned this phrase from my prof at Queens, versus those margin-sucking maggots. Shout out Ken Wong. And helps you sell quickly. Oh, April, you know Ken. But positioning alone, it's not enough. You need the second tool. You need the sales pitch to drive growth efficiently. As such, who better than to talk about positioning and sales pitch than the queen of positioning and author of Obviously Awesome and Sales Pitch. Welcome back, April. Welcome back.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much for having me. This is great.
I love having you. I remember you were our first guest when I did the first product marketing event in the world. It was April 22nd of 2016. And you were kind enough to come and be one of our speakers along with the infamous Ken Wong. And I've learned and I learned and
that
I continue
was
a, to
you know, that was an awesome event. That was the first time I had ever been in a room full of product marketers, like, and that was cool. Like, and I met a bunch of people at that thing that I still, you know, yak with a lot. It was just cool. It was like, wow, look at this. I've never seen a room of product marketers. Like, usually I'm standing in a room and it's half product management and there's a few product marketers sprinkled in there, or it's a general marketing conference and there's a few product marketers sprinkled in there. But a room full of product marketers, that was pretty cool. It was a neat event.
We are cool people, April. We are cool people. Morgan, you heard that? Product marketers are cool, good people.
Hey, look. I hear it.
Before we get started, for all the live guests on the show today, please, this is going to be interactive. We've taken a lot of your questions that you put on April's post. During your registration, you give us questions. We've tried to embed as many as possible, but still, put it in the chat as to what you want to talk about. You know, if certain things April, Morgan, myself are saying, you want some clarification, put it in the chat. We're going to try and get to it. Let's get going. Let's start with the basics foundation. April, set the record straight. What is positioning? What is it not?
All right. So positioning, you know, in my world, positioning defines how your product is the best in the world at delivering something, some value that, you know, a well-defined set of customers cares a lot about. So in my mind, it is distinctly different from a lot of things that we do with positioning after we have it. So it's not the same as messaging. It's not the same as, I don't know why it is, but when I work with people, companies, there's always somebody in the room that says, so we're making a tagline, right? That's what we're doing here. I'm like, no, man, it's not just a tagline. And then I have my personal pet peeve is people talking about brand positioning. And again, in my world, which is B2B kind of complex software tech, branding and positioning are two totally different things. And so, you know, there's branding and there's positioning. So when you say brand positioning, I don't know what the heck you're talking about. So that's my definition of what it is, what it ain't.
And I love that you've broken it down in such a disciplined way. Can you just give us a run through of the components of positioning just so we can level set for the for the rest of the conversation?
Yeah. So when I was early in this work, like, you know, back in the days when I was a little junior product marketer, people talked a lot about positioning, but they talked about it like this big nebulous thing. And my little brain had a hard time with that. And in particular, when I was trying to figure out, well, how do we actually do it? I felt like we needed to break it down into components, because sometimes we were talking about value, but we weren't always talking about value. We were also talking about target customers. We were also talking about market category. And so I thought, well, what exactly is it? So in my work, I think about it as having five component pieces. So it's the first one is competitive alternatives. Like, if you didn't exist, what would a customer do? So that's whatever the status quo is. It might be using a spreadsheet or manual processes, but that's also an alternative they might pick instead of you that looks a lot like you, which is a direct competitor. So that's the first thing, competitive alternatives. The second thing is differentiated capabilities. That's capabilities of your product and also capabilities of the company. So what do you got that the other guys don't have, capabilities-wise? And then we have differentiated value. So this is, you know, nobody really cares that much about your features. They care about what the features can actually do for their business. And so this differentiated value is, what is the value that we can deliver that no one else can? And then the fourth component is best fit customers, or, you know, what is the definition of a customer that is a very good fit for this product, meaning they care a lot about our value. And then the last bit is market category. Like, are you email or are you chat? Are you a database or are you a business intelligence tool? So what is the context that we position this product in such that the value kind of makes sense to the people we're trying to sell to? So in my world, those are the five components.
And just a follow-on question on that, you start with competitive alternatives rather than, you know, what we've been taught in school from day one is start with the customers. So start with your best fit customers. Why do you put competitive alternatives number one, best fit customers is number four in your components?
Well, because generally when we're talking about positioning, we're not talking about this in a conceptual manner, like the product doesn't exist yet and we're trying to brainstorm on what the product might be. Like, the product's out there. It's already there. You're already selling it. So what we need to understand before we get to anything else is, in the mind of a customer, what are the alternative ways of getting this job done? It, put another way, is what do I have to position against, or what do I have to beat in order to win a deal? So let's start there. Because if I start with customers, then it's like, well, which customers? Customers I wish we were selling to, or customers we're actually selling to? Here's the other thing. Like, I work a lot in B2B. A lot of times we can successfully sell to customers that are a terrible fit for us. That doesn't mean that we want to position ourselves for them. So sometimes we'll sell to customers that, you know, because we're great salespeople, we can get the customer over the line and buy, but then they churn in 2 months. So are we positioning for them? You know, like, what we really want to do is find out, why pick us? Like, why pick us over the other guys? Like, what do we got that the other guys don't have? And then look at, well, who cares a lot about that? Like, who cares a lot about the thing that only we can deliver? This is who we should be selling to. Whether or not we're selling to it is a different question. So if I started with customers and then try to back into it, I mean, that's a bit like the tail wagging the dog. In my mind, it's the same thing with people who want to start with market category. And they'll say, you know, well, we want to be the world's leading CRM. And it's like, are you though? And so there's a difference between what we aspire to be, you know, and maybe we will become that in the future, versus the reality on the ground of what we actually are right now. So in my mind, positioning is all about get into the best possible story for us in the market that helps us maximize the revenue we can squeeze out of the thing we have right now in the market conditions we have right now, against the competitors we have right now, to the buyers that we can actually sell to right now. Next year, maybe that's different. The year after, maybe that's different. 5 years from now, maybe that's different. But positioning is all about how do we maximize the revenue right now?
And just staying on positioning for one more question that we received is, if your position, how do you tackle positioning if you sell into multiple customer segments to different personas in that, in those segments?
Yeah, you know, so I've had a lot of experience with this because, you know, I've worked with companies where we've been really small and, you know, and there's just one persona and, you know, we got a database, we're selling to the CIO, it's always the CIO, we only sell to these kinds of companies and it's very easy and there's that. And then you've got other situations where, you know, in some cases I'm selling to utilities, but I'm also selling to retail. And you're like, oh no, is the positioning going to have to be different? Because utilities is very different from retail. They probably think about this differently. Here's what I found though, is often the marketers get themselves really twisted into a pretzel about this stuff. They're like, oh my gosh, I've got all these different personas and all these different segments, and I'm going to have this matrix of positioning for these different personas and these different segments, and this is going to be a nightmare. When I started out, I thought that's what I was going to have to do. But then what happened was, is it turned out that that actually isn't the way it works when you actually talk to customers. So two things I discovered. One is, if we're in B2B and we are selling to big company, there's often, I think the numbers are like there's 5 to 11 stakeholders in a B2B deal. And so let's say I'm selling to, you know, the head of database technology, but there's all these other people that care, right? So legal cares and the line of business cares and purchasing cares, and there's all these other people. But typically the way a B2B deal gets done is somebody is the champion. So somebody got tapped and they said, hey, get us a new ERP system. Would you like come back here and recommend what we're going to do? And it is that person's job to make the short list, figure out who they're going to go further with, figure out which vendors are on the short list. And then it's their job to sort of get everybody else, all the other stakeholders, make sure IT feels okay about it, make sure the end users feel okay about it, make sure my boss feels good about it, and maybe my boss's boss who's actually writing the check. And so that persona, that champion, is the only person that can make that deal happen. Everybody else are deal killers. They're not making the deal happen, but they can kill it. Like if IT shows up and says, oh, sorry, got to be SOC 2, otherwise we're not going to do the deal, your deal's dead, right? Or the end users go, this thing sucks, we're not going to use it, your deal's dead. Can the end user make the deal happen? No, only the champion can do that. So when we're talking about positioning, positioning is not the only tool we have in our kit bag when we're trying to sell a big deal to B2B, right? Positioning is going to help me get on the radar of the champion. Positioning is going to help me land on the short list. Once I'm on the short list and I have a deal cooking, well, then I've got sales teams and marketing people and everybody else. We're going to help the champion handle the objections, potentially, of all these other folks. But that's not positioning. That's something else. It's objection handling. So when I think about my positioning, do I have to understand the value for the IT department? No, there is no value for the IT department if they're not the champion. All the IT department has is a checklist of reason to kill your deal. So all they have is objections. So we're not out there writing value propositions and positioning for the IT department if all they're saying is, look, man, like the thing's too hard to manage. The thing doesn't comply. Oh, it doesn't integrate with our accounting software. They're just sitting over there with their checklist of things. So I've got to arm the champion to handle those objections, but that's not value. It's different. So that's the first thing you got to think about. The second thing is this idea I've got different segments. So what if I got a champion over in, you know, utilities and I got one in retail? The reason I'm using this example is I had this in a company. I came in, I'm the VP marketing. I came in, I did all this analysis, and we got this big pocket of customers in utilities and a big pocket of customers in retail. And you're like, well, shit, these are not the same. And so maybe I'm going to have different positioning for these two things. But the reality was that if you looked at it, the use case for these things was almost identical. And that would make sense. You know why? Because we have only one product that's serving both these things. And so when I did the positioning, it was like, well, who's the competitive alternatives? That they were slightly different, right? It was slightly different on the retail side, whatever. But then you looked at, well, what did we have that the other guys were going to have? That was kind of the same. And then when we got to the differentiated value, the value was identical. Like over in retail, we're worried about the cash registers turning off. Over in utilities, we're worried about the lights turning off. But otherwise, it's identical value. It's the same value. And it would make sense. So if you looked at the positioning, we had the exact same sales pitch for these two segments. The only thing that was different is when we got to the sales pitch and we were talking about the customer example, if it was retail, we talked about Tiffany's. And if it was utilities, we talked about this big utility we had in Texas as a customer. But otherwise, the value props were the same. The stuff was the same. And that would make sense. If it wasn't, then I would say maybe you don't have a positioning problem. Maybe you have a product strategy problem. Because if what I really have is two different things, meaning two different sets of competitors, two different value propositions, selling to two completely different types of buyers, then doesn't it make sense that those buyers want completely different things? Like your product roadmap for these two products is going to be different. It's going to be because you're trying to differentiate one set of competitors here and a different set of competitors here. Value props are totally different. So now you've got this issue. Are you going to fork it? Are you going to drop one segment? Because you can't serve both forever. So what it usually means if you have that in a position is truly different, which by the way, I've rarely seen, but if it's truly, truly different, then the question is, well, you know, we're in this weird little moment where you happen to have a product that serves both, but next year that ain't going to be true. The year after, it's not going to be true. So what are you going to do about that? So in general, what we have, like I've worked at some really big things, like where we've had $800 million revenue serving a lot of different segments and a lot of different personas and a lot of different things. One sales pitch, one positioning, serve everybody. Are there little tweaks we make in it? Yeah, we're not talking about the exact same customer example. Sometimes we tweak the words a little bit, but positioning, exactly the same.
I think one of the key elements that you talked about here that I think for everyone tuning in should pay attention to is as you're starting out, maybe some people that are here and you mentioned it, you start off ambitious. So you're like, we're going to be number one. So we need to go after every single person on earth where yeah. You have to start small and then obviously expand from there. But to your point, as you continuously get those customers, you're able to understand the customer stories within each industry and things of that nature. So as we now have gotten this foundation of positioning, I have a question for you. This is, you may or may not prepare for this one, April, but I got a question.
I'm prepared for all the questions.
I noticed that you have a background and you studied engineering in college. Would you say that your engineering background has helped you, let's say, as Rowan asked, break down this positioning into components? We're going to go into messaging and I'm curious on how you think about it. But do you feel like that engineering background has really helped you break these things down into components and has made it easier for people to do positioning because it can be daunting to a degree?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I think like the engineering background has been good for me. Like in the early stages of my career, it was good for me in a few ways. Like one, it was good for me in that, you know, developers were more likely to, and when I say developers, I mean the product management team as well, were more likely to actually take me seriously if they couldn't like bullshit me on crap, you know, like the first product I ever worked on was a database. And, you know, they were talking to me like I didn't know what an SQL query was. And I'm like, my dudes,
I've been
4 years of writing freaking SQL queries.
I know
like,
what those
you
are.
You know, I'm not saying I'm as technical as you, but, you know, don't be. So there was that. And then, but I did think that, you know, when I thought about positioning, I did think I came at it like a bit of an engineer. Like, you know, we can't just solve this big blob of a thing. Like we need to be able to break it into components and then figure out how the components relate to each other, which I think is a very engineering way of going about it. You know, on the flip side of it, you know, I don't think like I've written books, but you know, we have editors when we write books. Like I don't think I'm a very good writer, for example. And so if I think about the things I'm weak on, like when I manage teams internally, like one of my first hires was always to hire somebody that was really good on copy because, you know, my grammar is terrible, whatever. I write like an engineer. It's not good. You don't want me writing copy. So I think, you know, as marketers, I think it's important to understand where your strengths are, where your weaknesses are, and then hire around that. And so for me, you know, I was good at this bigger picture stuff. I always had a good time getting on with the technical side of the business. But when it came to some of the more like, you know, creative stuff, I would have to hire people to do that stuff because that's not my jam.
That makes complete sense. And this now is going to move into the messaging piece, right? You mentioned copy too. This will probably go into it. Could you break down the difference between positioning versus messaging?
I talk about this a lot with my own clients because, you know, often what we've got is, you know, the company will come to me and say, I don't like the messaging. Like the CEO will come to me and say, I don't like the words on the homepage. I don't think the words on the homepage make sense to our customers and they don't represent what we actually do. And in my mind, positioning is an input to messaging, but it's not the same thing as messaging. Like part of what we're doing in positioning is getting a really tight definition of, well, who exactly do we compete with? Like if we didn't exist, what would a customer do? And defining that is not messaging, but we need it to write good messaging. It's an input to messaging. But defining that in my mind, that's a part of positioning. And then defining what our value themes are, like, which is the answer to the question, like what value can we deliver that no one else can? In my mind, we define that in positioning. When we start to think about, well, what are the words we're using to capture that? Now we're getting closer to messaging, which is, you know, how do we capture this positioning in words and sentences and, you know, verbally? Then I think we're getting into messaging. Same thing with like, you know, we need to tightly define an ICP, like who are we actually going after? And in my mind, that discussion around how do we define who's a really good fit for this product? That's not messaging, but we need that to build good messaging. So it's an input to good messaging. Same thing with market category. Like what is the actual definition of the market category that we intend to win? So these things in my mind, you have positioning is kind of like this foundational thing. Like we're agreeing on this set of things. And then once we have that, then we can say, okay, what should the messaging be? What should the tagline be? What should the words on the homepage talk about? If we're going to do campaigns, you know, what should the campaign, you know, what's the campaign about? What are the words going to look like about that? So in my mind, positioning kind of comes first. And in where I come from, I think branding is an output of that as well. If you came to me and said, you know, if you came to me and said, April, we need to do messaging for this homepage, I'd say, great. Like, who's your competitor? How are you different? What's the value you can deliver that they can't? Who exactly is the key buyer that we're trying to target? And then I could write the positioning. It's the same thing with branding. If you came and said, we need to do branding, I'd say, great. So, you know, what's our value? Who are we selling to? How are we different than the other folks we're selling against? And I would figure out what the branding around that would need to represent, right? What's the vibe we're going for? What's the tone of voice we're going for? If you came and said, I've got this company and we sell stuff to daycares. And, you know, so we're selling to the head of programming at a daycare. You can imagine what that branding might look like, right? Or might feel like, or the tone of it might like, and what we're trying to convey. It's going to be kind of playful. It might be, you know, it's going to be kind of earthy, and it's going to, you know, there's going to be kids and stuff. Whereas if you come and I say, well, I have a cybersecurity tool that I sell to big insurance companies, I don't want playful.
Yeah,
I want to be
so
freaking
different.
Serious.
Yeah, different vibe.
I want you to feel trustworthy and solid and whatever. And, you know, and I need all the acronyms of all the things that you comply with and all that crap. Like, and that's going to be different, very different branding. But
yes.
I can't figure out what the branding looks like until you tell me, like, well, who's it for? And what are we trying to convey? And what, you know, what's the whole vibe of this thing? And then we can figure that out. Now, the branding people will argue with me, right? Like, there's some branding people that say, like, they've stretched the definition of branding to mean everything, including positioning, which I think is not helpful to people trying to get it done.
So that was my next question. Helpful for people looking to get it done. This might cause a fight in the comments, who knows, but who owns this decision with messaging? Is it Is it sales? Is it product marketing? Is it the CEO? Like, who's like, okay, this is our messaging moving forward?
Well, so in my world, like, so I was always the VP marketing, right? So this was my track, right? So after being a product marketer, I became the vice president of marketing. And so positioning was pretty important to me and my ability to get shit done, because if the positioning is terrible, I can't run good campaigns to like generate leads and do stuff for the sales team. Like everything I'm doing is going to be crap if the inputs are crap, right?
Yeah,
so
of course.
And you often get this, like marketing will feel the pain often before anyone else does. Although sometimes sales feels it too. They don't always know it's positioning, but they'll feel it too. Yep. So I would come in and people would say, okay, April, you know, you're the brand new VP marketing. Would you wave that magic lead wand and get them leads rolling and get the revenue going up like this and go. And I would show up. Right. And I would show up and be like, well, hold up. I don't know nothing here. I'm stupid. I'm brand new. I just got here and I'm going to need a few weeks to figure out. And what I'd be trying to figure out is the positioning okay or not? Because if it's not, we got to fix that first. And so what I would do to figure that out is like, I couldn't just show up and then roll up to the founder who's been doing this for 15 years and I'm brand new and I've been here 15 minutes and show up and say, oh, I looked at your baby and it's ugly. And so I would like to change the baby. Like that, this is never going to fly at all, right?
No.
So instead what I would do is I would go and sit in and listen on sales calls. And weak positioning on a first substantive sales call sounds like this. It sounds like this. You got a good rep that does a good job. They're experienced. They've been pitching this thing for a while. They do a good job telling the story. Customer comes in, reps, you know, talking to the customer, and they're a little bit through trying to explain what we do. And the customer is getting this face like, your brow's getting all scrinkly. And they're like, wait, wait, wait. And you'll hear the customer go, wait, 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 wait. Back up. Back it up. Go back two slides. You know the other slide you had? Back up to that. And then pitch it to me again. And so you'll get this fundamental confusion about like, what the heck is this thing? Sometimes what you'll hear is the customer will say, oh, yeah, I get what you are. You're just like HubSpot. But you're nothing like HubSpot. Like you're not. And then the rep is like, no, let me go back. No, I'm going to go back. We're going to go back and do it again. Or you'll get this really terrifying one where the customer goes, yeah, I get it. I get it. I get what you are. I get who your competitors are. I get it. I just don't get why anybody would pay for that. Like, why wouldn't I just do that in a spreadsheet? Or why wouldn't I just, like, I could hire an intern and get that done. Or I could just use my ERP system. They kind of do that. Like, why by you? So it means they kind of get what you are, but they just don't think the value is valuable. Like they don't get the value. And so if you're hearing that a lot on sales calls, that would indicate to me that potentially we have a positioning problem and we should look at it. And so I would then have lunch with the VP sales and we'd have lunch and I'd say, look, I'm stupid. I'm new here. I don't know anything, but I was listening to 5 or 6 sales calls over here and I keep hearing this thing. Do you think we have that problem? Like, do people have a hard time figuring out where we are? And 9 times out of 10, the head of sales will say, oh yeah, man, I hear that in all the calls. It's weird. It takes us like 2-3 calls before the light goes on, the customer gets what we are. And I'm like, ah, okay. So in marketing, that's often a sign of weak positioning. So have we ever done a positioning exercise here? Have we ever looked at it? And the VP sales would say, no, we never have. And I'd say, well, you know what? I'm new here, but you know, maybe that would be a good thing for us to do. I'm going to talk to some people about that. And then I would have the same conversation with product. And I'd be like, look, I've been hanging out in sales and I'm hearing this. Do you think that's true? Do you see that too? And if I hear a yes, yes from sales and product, well, then we probably have a positioning product. Then I go to the CEO or the founder and say, look, I'm still a dummy, but I'm hearing this over in sales. And where I come from, that's often a positioning problem. Have we ever done something? Like, it would be neat to get a little gang together and just sit down and have a look at this positioning. Maybe we don't change it. Maybe it stays the same, but it's probably worth having a look at it. And the first thing the founder says is, did you talk to John over in sales? And I always say, let's call him. Let's call him and see what he says. Then John in sales will go, yeah, I've been thinking about this for a while. Yeah, I think we should, you know. So anyway, so I can make this decision on my own. Like, I think if marketing's trying to do this on their own, that's the wrong way to do it. Like, We feel the pain, but sales is feeling the pain too. Product is feeling the pain too. And if I'm brand new, like maybe I'm wrong. Maybe the positioning's okay. Maybe we got a different problem. And so I got to figure it out cross-functionally. And then if we're going to fix it, I need sales on board with this positioning. I need product on board with this positioning. I definitely need the founder on board with it. So if I don't involve them in fixing it, it's never going to stick. Like if I just cook it up in the marketing department and then let it loose on everything, sales is going to be like, well, we don't agree with that. We don't like it. We think that's stupid. Or the founder's going to come and say, I don't know where this came from. Like, what is this thing? And they'll just keep doing the old positioning. So what I learned being in-house is I got to get a cross-functional team together. And then once we get the cross-functional team together, I got to have a process to work through it. Because if I get everybody together and I just say, why does everybody love our stuff? Well, then now I got a big fight between sales and the founder, and they're just going to have an argument. With marketing, no one cares what marketing has to say about this. And then, you know, and then they'll have a big fight, and one of them will win. It'll be based on nothing, and then we'll still have shitty positioning. So what we need is a process to take the team through that, for as much as we can, takes the opinions out of it and sort of builds on something. So that's what my work does. And then once the thing is done, you know, marketing's going to be involved in a lot of the execution of the positioning, figuring out what the messaging is that reflects the positioning, figuring out what the pitch is that reflects the positioning. But I've got everybody in agreement and alignment on it, so nobody's fighting me. Now they're all working with me on it. And so in my world, that was the only way I could figure out how to get it done and have it stick successfully. So it's a long answer to who should own this thing. Like the idea is, I think once we've done the positioning, marketing is kind of the steward of it. Product marketing in particular, if you have product marketers. And I think product marketers can help be, you know, help be kind of the positioning police to make sure that everybody's in line with the positioning. But then I think we also need a process to check in on it regularly, get the gang back together. Like the actual development of positioning is a cross-functional team effort, in my opinion.
So what I'm hearing, Rowan, is that sales owns everything. And everyone should just take a step back.
I think marketing trying to like, I think one of the stupidest things that marketing can do is try to build a sales pitch without sales involvement.
Oh, amen.
Yeah. Like never in the history 100%. Of the world has this worked.
It never has worked. Every time I go to Oren, like this isn't it. I could tell immediately, like we need to set some stuff up.
And yet marketing people do it all the time.
They do?
And then they complain. They like build the thing and they throw it over the thing and they're like, those jerks over in sales. They don't use any of the stuff I give them. I give them my genius stuff.
Or they'll make the mistake of building it themselves in-house. And they're, you know, ivory tower, if you will. But they allow a little bit of a review process with sales and product. That's not the same as cross-functionally building the thing together. So I'm 100% with you. And great segue into... I have so many questions, but Morgan, keep going. I know you have some.
I know. I see you brewing. I'm going to hand it off to you in a minute. But I have one question for the audience that is important because we're talking about this, right? Because let's say, okay, we do have alignment. Everyone agrees this is the right messaging. We have this question from Michelle from the audience. How do you combat salespeople who think they don't need the perfect world step, which I mean, I guess like the perfect pitch, and they twist the perfect setup.
And they just want to pitch features.
They just want to pitch features and just do their own thing after we've done all this work.
Yeah. So it's interesting. Like I would say the majority of the companies that I work with, if you know, so before we do a positioning thing, I generally have them like, send me your sales pitch. Let's have a look at it. And the most common sales pitch I see is a sales pitch that is basically a product walkthrough and it's just a feature dump. Like, it will literally be a demo that says, look, we have 7 drop-down menus. I'm clicking on every one and I'm going to talk about every single thing. And and these pitches work sometimes. Like where you have a really educated buyer, you know, that has done their homework and is looking at the different options they could pick. Sometimes they're going to pick you. You know, they're going to weed through all this stuff. They're going to pick you. However, it is putting all the onus on the buyer, right? Like it. If you think about it, when a person comes in, particularly in B2B, in the space where I work, it's B2B, it's a little bit bigger deal. Everybody's got a short list, right? They're not just looking at you. They're looking at you and 2-3 other options. And so we're doing these pitches, These pitches are designed to answer the question, why pick us? Right? So maybe we're going to show you all the things, and this is why you should pick us. We do all these things. But that's not the customer's question. The customer's question is, why pick you over the other guys? And so what it's not doing is it's not answering the question, does everybody have these features? Are 90% of these features table stakes for every single thing in the, and so, you know, what have you got that's different? It's not answering that. And then it's also not answering why these features matter. It is treating all the features as the same, and you figure it out. You figure out why it matters for your business. So you're actually making the customer do a lot of work. But sometimes you have sales reps that, you know, they're very comfortable with this style of pitch. Often they have the sales engineer come in and do the pitch, and they don't even have to pitch at all. So this is great. They just say, hang back.
Yeah.
The sales engineer does the demo. And then they're like, okay, let's have another thing. I was first exposed to, you know, a pitch that was very different from that when I worked for IBM. And so the neat thing about the IBM pitch is they never did that, ever. They would always roll up and say, look, you know, like, and we'd be selling something that was really boring and undifferentiated, like a database, right? Like, there's a mature market. Everybody's database looks exactly the same. And so they would roll up and say, databases, why do we care? Like, what do we want out of data? And then we would have this point of view. And we come in and say, you know what? There's lots of databases out in the world. Like, the databases exist all over. And we all agree that, like, data is growing exponentially. And why? Because data is really important to the enterprise right now. We expect to do a lot of stuff with this data. And if we think about that, really, data is becoming this source of innovation in the enterprise. We've seen it. We're IBM. We see it all the time. And so if you really think about data being a source of innovation in the enterprise, well, wouldn't you want a database that could support that? Now, what does a database that supports innovation look like? Well, it's really open. Plays nice with all kinds of tools you're using today, but also the tools you want to use in the future and do all this stuff that you don't even know what it's going to be yet. So you want that, you know, and so we would have this pitch that would go like that, and we would get you aligned on what your purchase criteria should even be. Because otherwise, if we didn't do that, then we're just going to be a feature function checklist with Oracle, and it's just going to be like, which one's cheaper? You guys look exactly the same. But we came at it and said, well, the one way we're different from Oracle is our stuff is way open. It plays nicer with other things. Oracle's trying to sell you the whole stack and the database is just a piece in there. And so we combat that with this whole different point of view by going in and saying, you don't want that. You want this other thing. And this is a much more effective pitch, particularly when we think about we have customers that they don't know what they're looking at. They don't know what their purchase criteria should be. Most of the time, we're selling software to somebody who's never bought a product like ours before. We're showing them all the features. They're already overwhelmed with features. Like, if they could make a decision just looking at a feature function checklist, why do we have a salesperson at all? Right? The salesperson is there to teach us something about the market. The salesperson is there to answer the question, why pick you over the other guys? So we should have a pitch that answers that question, in my opinion. All the research shows, if you look at the research on this, when we talk to B2B buyers and we ask them, what do you want from a sales conversation? The top two answers are they want perspectives on the market and they want help navigating alternatives. Given a feature function checklist demo doesn't answer either of those questions.
No, and that information is even more accessible nowadays. To be fair.
Right. I can just get it off the website. Why do I need you, buddy?
It's like YouTube video. There's different sites out there for that now. Like, that doesn't provide any context whatsoever.
Anything. Like the customer's coming to you because they know all that, right?
Yeah.
We know it. But we're looking at it and saying, I don't know. Like, I know you have this one feature that the other guys don't, but I don't know why it matters.
Yeah.
I don't know why it matters. Should I worry about this? Should my company worry about this? Or is this just a thing for big companies and I'm not a big company? Or this is a thing that matters to little companies. I'm not little companies. Like, what they want is a sales rep that can paint a picture of the world and then position us in it and say, look, if you're worried about these four things, you should pick us. Like, that's what they want. And we're, you know, and just throwing in the towel and saying, I don't know, I'm just going to show you all the stuff and you figure it out. You know, you tell us what you pick, you do it. That's just like, it's basically saying, we're not here to sell anything, buddy. Like, we're just here to show you this stuff. In which case, let's fire all the sales reps and replace them with sales engineers that you can just click on the thing. In fact, let's just do a self-serve demo.
Michelle Robbins, and I know Michelle Robbins from the CMO Coffee Chats, great individual. You opened a can of worms, Michelle, with that one bloody question.
Well,
but this is a great segue into April. The reason I buy your book is more than you're just my neighbor here in Toronto. You give us a disciplined approach to positioning. And then with this, you added discipline to how to tell that pitch. And to your point where customers want to learn about perspectives on their category of the market, they want to learn and help you navigate, you know, help them, guide them in navigating alternatives. Let's go through how we do that with your construct of a sales pitch. If you don't mind, just let's level set. Let's pretend people haven't read the book, and those people, my God, you're missing out. Go get the damn book.
Thank you.
Walk us through the components of the sales pitch.
So what I wanted to do was write a book about positioning, right? Because I felt like people were doing positioning, but they weren't doing it. What we didn't have was a step-by-step way to get it done, or at least I didn't have that when I was in-house. And I thought, and so eventually I got one that I thought worked for me inside the kind of companies I work for. And I thought, well, this is better than starting with nothing. So I'm going to write this down in a book. And if people find it useful, that's great, whatever. So I wrote the first book and that was that. But in the work I was doing with clients, and this was true even when I was in house, if we did the positioning and we just left it at that, it wouldn't stick because if we had salespeople, it was very critical to make sure that we had a pitch that represented the positioning that the salespeople could use in a first call. Otherwise, you know, we'd be telling this story over at marketing and then they'd get over to sales and they'd be like, okay, I got 7 drop-down menus, here we go, right? And there's no positioning happening there at all. So in the work that I was doing with clients, we do this positioning stuff exactly the way it's laid out in book one. And then we would do this little exercise at the end to take the positioning and map it to a sales pitch and map out a sales pitch. Like, here's how we tell the story. My initial assumption when I started consulting was that, you know, how we build a sales pitch is a previously solved problem. Like, we know how to do this. There's people out there that know what good pitches should look like. You know, maybe most of these companies aren't doing a good pitch, but, you know, we know how to do it. And so I thought, well, I'll just find somebody else's sales pitch structure and I'll use that because that exists, right? And it turns out, kind of surprisingly, there isn't a lot written about how to build a sales pitch, which is pretty surprising because unlike on the marketing side, the salespeople do a lot of structured training. Like most of the salespeople I've worked with, they've done Sandler selling and spin selling, and they've been through all kinds of sales training. And in that training, they teach you a lot about how to build rapport with a client, how to handle objections, how to move a deal along, how to negotiate pricing, how to get buy-in. There's a whole bunch of this really important stuff that you learn when you go to sales school. But there's an assumption that the pitch just exists, which I think is very funny because so that salespeople are like, well, the pitch just exists. And then you go over to marketing and marketing's like, well, we build a stupid pitch and then we give it to them and then they don't use it, right? And the problem is the marketers are building a pitch that's useless to sales because they haven't been through Sandler sales training and all this sort of stuff. They don't really know what discovery is. They don't really know how salespeople handle objections and all this stuff. So I decided, you know what, maybe like, and I'm not saying mine is the only way you could build a sales pitch. I think there's 1,000 ways to build a good sales pitch, but most people aren't using any structure to use a sales pitch. So I think my structure is better than none.
People out here being reckless sometimes.
So my structure is the one I was using when I was internal. And so when I started out, I was, you know, my pitches looked just as shitty as everybody else's because that's how we were all building pitches as product walkthrough. If we were getting really fancy, we'd talk about the problem in the first slide. And so if I was selling a database, I'd be like, you know what the problem is? Too much data. Data is growing exponentially. You know what you need? A database. Yeah, then any of my competitors could say that. like anybody. It was a wasted slide. And the customer would be like, yeah, dummy, we all know that. Get on with the pitch. And then I might have like a logo slide at the end. Like, look, we're not three people in a basement. You know, we sold Morgan Stanley once, you know. And then I went to IBM. And what I saw at IBM was this completely different style of pitch. Like they were doing this pitch where they were talking about their point of view in the market. They were trying to establish purchase criteria. They never talked about features outside of the context of value. And so after I built a bunch of pitches with the, and if you want to know where IBM got that structure, they got it from working with the CEB, which is the customer, what were they called? CAB, with the customer.
CEB. They're the ones who did the Challenger sale and
Challenger
all that.
Challenger sale. And they were like the world's greatest sales training people. Anyways, and so their pitch came out of some work they did for there, and it was built custom for IBM. Anyways, so when I left IBM, I went to this smaller company, they were like 80 million revenue, and I joined the same time as the new VP sales, and that tells you how good things were going there. And then we did a repositioning, and I said, hey, we should restructure this sales pitch because we got to build a new sales pitch, and I like, you know, showed him the IBM stuff that I was using, and we built a new pitch, but we kind of startupified the IBM structure because there was a bunch of stuff in there that was very specific to IBM. And then I've been using sort of an evolving version of that structure ever since. So when the clients come and work with me, they use this structure that I've been using like since back when I was in-house, but now I use it with clients and I've used it with like, I don't know, 300 clients now. So I think it works pretty good. Not everybody uses it exactly the structure. Like you're welcome to mess with it and do whatever you want with it, but I think it's a lot better than having nothing. So with that as the preamble, what the structure looks like is the pitch itself has kind of two pieces. There's like a setup and a follow through. The setup isn't about you and your product. The setup is about your point of view on the market and how we could look at all the different alternatives and what the pros and cons of the different alternative approaches to the problem might be. And then getting a level set with the customer, we're like, look, like if this is really what we're trying to do here, and these are the pluses and minuses of doing it in different ways, can we all agree that a perfect solution would kind of tick these boxes? And if we can get the customer to go, yeah, we can agree, then the back of the pitch is the meat of the pitch where you're like, okay, great. Now let me show you what we got. Let me show you how we tick those boxes. This is how we do it. And so then we're talking about value and the features are just like, here's how we do it. And so that's what my structure at a super high level. That's what my structure looks like.
And within the setup, I know you have three components. You have insight, competitive alternatives, and then the perfect world.
Yeah.
Can you give us just a little tidbit on each of those three? How are people creating a point of view and insight that is really going to resonate? When you talk about competitive alternatives and pros and cons, I'm assuming you're leading to some sort of bias that, you know, you're obviously.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the perfect world. Can you just do a little bit on those three? And then we'll get to the follow throughs.
So we have this positioning, right? So we've done this positioning exercise. We have positioning. And in that positioning, you know, we know what our differentiated value is. So earlier I used the example of IBM with the databases, right? So, you know, if we did the positioning for that IBM database, our differentiated value was, you know, our database was better than everybody else's database. The differentiated capability was we played nice with all the other things. We had a better API. We had more connectors. We adhered to more standards. This was the capability. The value of that was, you know, this database played really nicely with anything else in your ecosystem to make it really easy to get data in and out of there. No matter what you're using today or what you're going to do in the future, this thing is going to be this hub of innovation. That was our whole thing. Now, if we're building a pitch for this, the first thing we'd need to say is, well, you know, what does a customer need to understand in order to understand that value? You'd need to understand this whole idea of data as a driver of innovation. That's our unique insight. We look at the world that way, and that's very different from how Oracle looks at it. Oracle says, well, you just want the database to play nice with the whole stack of things, and then if something goes wrong, you just call Oracle because it's all Oracle. And that makes it really easy to deploy, and you don't have to integrate with anything else and all that stuff. So that's great. You know, it might be a little cheaper and you might be faster to deploy. The downside of that, though, is, you know, you want to attach some new thing, some new jazzy AI thing comes up and you want it to talk to that. Good luck. Right? Doesn't work. They don't adhere to the standards we do. They don't have the night, whatever. So we would have to make this. So if I was doing a pitch for IBM and all I got is this story about openness, well, I better make openness really damn important. So the first part of this pitch is this insight. And so we would start the pitch with, like, why do we care about databases? Right? Why do we care about data? We care about it because there's all this cool stuff we're going to do with data in the future if we have enough of it. And that includes AI, that includes machine learning, that includes all this cool stuff we're going to do. Data is one of our key innovation assets inside a big organization, which is who we're selling to. So I start with that insight and I'm having a conversation with the customer. And then I say, okay, now you're looking at buying a database. That's why we're here. That's why we're having this conversation. And there's lots of databases out there. But let me tell you, you have options. Some of these databases out there, so this is the second step. So I got insight. I start with that. Data is my foundation of innovation. Second step is pluses and minuses of different alternatives. Well, I could buy another database. I could buy a database that comes in a stack where you buy the applications and the thing and all together. And that's good because it's all pre-integrated. It's fast to deploy. It's probably cheaper, you know, to do that. What's the downside of it? Doesn't play nice with anything else. You want to replace the bits of the stack? Good luck, right? Oh, there's other ways to do it, right? I could, like, at the time we had, there were other styles of databases. And so we would talk about that too. So, and notice how I didn't say the name. Like, I didn't say Oracle sucks. You shouldn't pick them. I said, look, here's a style. And you might not care as much about innovation as you do about cost. And if you do, then maybe you pick them. And then we'll say, but, and then we get to my perfect world. So in a perfect world, if we believe that data management, the reason we're storing all this data and the reason we're trying to manage all this data is because what we want is innovation for the future. Don't we want a database that has amazing APIs? Don't we want a database that adheres to all the standards and a company that believes in that, that it sits on all the standard bodies and is going to do that in the future? Don't we want that? And your client is either yes or no at this point. Like, the client is either like, yeah, man, I want that. Or they're like, nah, we're just worried about the budget, man. Then, well, okay, I got nothing for you. Nice talking. Bye-bye. But, or the customer is like, yeah, we care about that. We want that. So that's my setup. That, you know, so if I have a 45-minute sales call, that setup might take 5 minutes. Right. And then I get to this point where I'm like, we want this, right? And if the customer is like, yeah, we do. And then you go, great. Then I switch to the follow through. And the follow through starts with, hey, we're IBM. Yeah. So we believe this. So because we believe this, and this is our point of view in the market, we have built a database this way. And so, you know, here's IBM database. Here's what it looks like. And here's my value points. One, the world's most amazing API. Here's how it works, blah, 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 blah. Adherence to standards, like, oh my God, we're sitting on 59,000 standards bodies and we're writing the standards and nobody adheres to standards like SDA. You know, so then I have this thing, which is value. Here's how we do it. Value. Here's how we do it. And then I finish off the pitch with, you know, usually it's proof that we can do what we say we can do. So in the case of IBM, it's here's the number of standard bodies we're sitting on and blah, blah, blah. We might have a customer case study in there where they're talking about cool shit they're doing with weird tools that would never integrate with Oracle in 1,000 years. And then, you know, if there's unspoken objection, we would handle that. And then we'd end the pitch with the ask, like, this is what we want you to do next, which in the case of IBM is like, you know, we would send a couple of people in on site to look at their data and their structure and whatever. And then we would move towards a proof of concept. So that's like at a very high level, that's what the pitch structure looks like.
We wrap up here in the last couple of minutes to get some of the audience questions real quick at rapid fire. I think the structure was incredible. But Rowan, I don't know if anything that you want to touch on as we wrap up here.
I'll share one of them. Surbhi Gupta asked this almost at the start when we were on positioning, but I think it's applicable to the insight portion of building out the sales pitch. While building your ideal company profile and really understanding who to go after, who this positioning and sales pitch is for, are you looking and focusing on your current customer list, analyzing company size, geography, buyer user personas, pain points, or are you starting outside in? How are you doing the research to inform your positioning and sales pitch, especially the insight for your sales pitch?
Well, so again, like, it would be different if we were talking about, like, if this was like a research project, like we're thinking about building a brand new product, or we're thinking about building a new, big new feature for the product, there would be a big research project that goes around that, right? What do people want? Are we building the right thing? Like, there'd be this whole product management process, right? What are we building? Are we building the right thing? Are we doing whatever, blah, 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 blah. This is not what we're doing in positioning. What we're doing in positioning is, we got a product, it's in market already. We know who the competitors are. We know who we have to be. We know who we're trying to sell to today, right? Next year, this might be different. We might release something new and then everything's going to be different. Then we'll have to figure that out. But I've got a thing in market that I'm selling right now. And so we're dealing with a lot of knowns. And so we're not, most of the time with the companies that I'm working with, like, I have a sales team, and that sales team is selling to this customer all day, all night. So they know who the competitors are that we have to beat. They know, you know, they know what those customers think is valuable and isn't valuable, because they're trying to sell to them all day. Our product management team knows where we have features that are different than those main competitors. And because we know a lot about buyers and customers, you know, we know what the value is that those features can deliver. So we can figure that out. This isn't necessarily a research project, because, you know, we're already doing this. We're already in market. We're already doing this stuff. Now, occasionally we might have something that, you know, we don't really know, or that, you know, there's a question about it, and then we'll test it. But it's often not something where we're doing a big research project first, and then we're coming in like we would if it was a brand new product or a brand new feature and we just didn't know yet, and we're, you know, about to launch it, or we've just launched it, we only got two customers and we got to try to figure it out. Most of the time, that's not the positioning I'm working on. Is we got a thing, it's in market, we're already selling it. We're just trying to get a really tight story that sells more of it. And the assumption that I go in with is sales knows a lot about how customers buy. Product knows a lot about what's differentiated and what isn't differentiated in the competitive landscape. Marketing knows a lot about value and what doesn't work in the lead generation process. And you know, what we're trying to do is suck all that stuff out together. Like, if I go to your main sales rep and say, what's the champion of a typical deal? They know the answer to this. I don't have to go do a research project to go figure it out. They know the answer to this question. They're already in market. They're already doing this stuff. Now, what you often get, and I'm going to say something that's a little controversial here, new marketers will show up and assume nobody knows anything. And I've seen that a lot. The brand new VP marketing will show up and say, oh my God, no one knows who the target customer here is here. Nobody knows what the value is. Nobody knows. We don't know. We're going to have to do a big research project. And they'll do a big research project, and then they'll present that project, the results of that project, to the head of sales and the head of product and the founders, and they'll end up looking at the head of marketing and say, that's pretty interesting, but you know what? We already knew all that. So not that I don't think there's, you know, research has its place, particularly when we're talking about new stuff, but a lot of times I think marketing's doing a lot of really useless research to educate themselves because they don't believe what sales tells them.
On that note, we are at time.
We're going to end on that?
That's it. we'll end with this one thing. If based on all your client interactions, feedback from your book, sales pitch, let's use the sales pitch book. What is the one thing folks constantly get wrong as it relates to approaching, building, you know, rolling out the sales pitch? What is that one thing you keep hearing over and over again, and how do you fix it?
Like, I do think the biggest problem that companies have is, particularly when I'm talking to marketers, is they're just not working well with their sales team. So because they're not working well with the sales team, they're blind to what's happening in sales. And so they don't, because they don't have a good relationship with the VP sales, they don't have a good relationship with a bunch of the sales. And what develops is this kind of animosity where sales is looking at marketing and saying, these people know nothing. They're idiots. Like, they're running these campaigns that are stupid. They're giving us leads that are awful. We hate those guys. They don't deliver any value. And marketing is kind of saying the same thing, like looking over at sales and saying, like, these people are just acting like the Wild West. They're pitching whatever. Their pitches are terrible. They don't do a good job. I send them all this good stuff and they just ignore it. As opposed to trying to work together and find out what's really working, like what's really working in sales and what's really not working in sales. And then how do we build on that and make it better? And so the teams that I've seen that work really well on this stuff, marketing and sales are just like joined at the hip and working really well together. And there's a respect there for the work that happens on both sides. So I think, you know, and again, I'm biased because I'm talking about big ticket B2B stuff where that connection really, really matters. It's different if what you're selling is a $100 thing off the website and you're just doing a transaction with credit cards. Like, that's a whole different kettle of fish. And by the way, in that situation, you absolutely do need market research because you don't have any salespeople. You don't know what the heck is going on there unless you actually go out and research to figure it out.
Love it. Positioning, sales pitch, these are tools for efficient growth. They're tools that need to be treated in a disciplined manner. Appreciate you, April, as always. If you haven't already, I don't do this. I don't do commercials. I don't do people. People don't come on the show because they paid me to be on the show. I only invite people on the show who I get value as a product marketer from. Do yourself a favor and go buy the damn books. It's the most pragmatic things you will read as it relates to positioning and sales pitch. That's the end of that. Thank you. See you next time. Have a good one.
Okay. Thanks so much.
See you, everybody.